I'm Bob Darrell, I'm an alcoholic. I was fairly new. A guy cornered me after a meeting about step three. I've only ever had two problems with step three, step one and step two. And this guy corners me after the meeting, and he says, you got to take step three. And I said to Joe, I can't. I don't know if there's a God or not. And he says, you don't have to believe in God or know, but there's a God to take step three. And I said, well, that's what it says, Joe, God as we understood him. He said, listen, kid, if you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair, and he points at this chair, he says, I promise you an instant miracle. So I said, okay, I turn my will, my life over to the chair. What's the miracle? He says, well, the miracle would be your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. And when I didn't even get my feelings hurt. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Yep. Because if you'd have followed me around and watched me, maybe as your loved ones or friends or family have watched you the last couple years before you got sober, it'd become very apparent that whoever's making decisions for this person is out to kill them. But yet, isn't it funny it doesn't look that way in here? Because I can minimize my involvement in disasters. I can rationalize and justify stuff. I don't actually, I'm not really in touch with reality. I have stories about reality in my head. There was a guy named Dale who, when I was new, he cornered me one time, and Dale said to me, he says, listen, kid, I'm going to tell you something that'll save you a lot of grief. He said, kid, I want you to know that if you're explaining something, if you're rationalizing something, if you're defending something, if you're justifying something, kid, I want you to know you're wrong. Because you never have to justify, rationalize, defend, or explain what's right. And that's exactly right. I only have to, it's my ego that wants to justify its own position and has to tell myself the story about my intentions and motives and how this is not really like you think it is. The problem is I listen to the story of my life. Everybody else actually sees it. Right? There's a delusion that it talks about on page 61 and right in the middle of the page, about two lines down from the middle. It's the one that I believe that if as long as I maintain this delusion, I will never really be happy. I'll be a driven guy. And it says, is he not a victim of the delusion that he can rest? I like that word, rest. There's a little bit angst in the word rest. That he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well. Down to the core of my being is this idea that if I was loved the right way, if I was properly financed, if I was properly respected, if people could see the truth, if I could get all my ducks in a row, surely at that point I will have wrested happiness and satisfaction out of this world. And the reason it's a delusion, drunk or sober, I don't think there's a demographic on the planet that's ever spent more time, more energy, more money, more obsessive focus on making ourselves happy and satisfied as we have. And the end result is some of us are trying to get pills or commit suicide or all kinds of stuff. The end of it is the end results, we end up in AA. Absolute failure at my ability to wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world by managing well. And yet, there's a dynamic in AA that's a little strange. I've seen this in two parts, and it has to do with the first half of step one and the second half. I used to go to a meeting at St. Vincent's in Las Vegas. Now, St. Vincent's is the bottom of the food chain for recovery. This St. Vincent's is the place where the people in the other treatment centers say, well, if I was ever got that bad, you know, there ain't nothing below St. Vincent's. I mean, that's it. It's a homeless shelter. And I remember years ago, there'd be about 15 or 20 of us from the outside that would bring a meeting in there. Guys are driving up there in their brand new cars and coming from their houses and offices and nicely dressed. comfortable people, and there's all these homeless guys in there that look horrible. They look like alcoholics. Matter of fact, if you turn to the dictionary and look under the word alcoholic, you'd see one of their pictures in there. These guys look like alcoholics. The guys coming in from the outside don't look like alcoholics. And yet they'd always ask the same question at the beginning of the meeting. Well, the real alcoholics raise their hand. All the guys that don't look like alcoholics, oh, they're all got their hands up in there. The guys that look like alcoholics, oh, no, no. Victim of circumstances, bad breaks, a society that's trying to suppress guys like me. It's never, they don't think they're alcoholic. And yet they look like alcoholic. And also, I've noticed that people whose life appears the most manageable will diligently live a life where they're trying not to manage it. You want to see somebody whose life appears unmanageable, that they're depressed and full of anxiety all the time, they're burning one relationship after another, one problem after another? Watch them and see if they don't look like someone who's diligently trying to manage their own life. Absolute failure. That brings us to page 63. A friend of mine calls it the formal terms of surrender, the third step prayer. I'm going to read this prayer, and I would, if you'd like to, there's no pressure. Just everybody around you will know you're not saying it if you don't. If you'd like to join and say this prayer out loud along with me, please feel free. God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. It says we thought well before taking this step. Well, it's too late. You already did it. When I was about almost a year, towards the end of my first year of sobriety, I guess, I got down on my knees with another member of AA, and I said that prayer right out of the book there. And I had read page 60 through 63 several times. And if you would, and the guy asked me, "Do you know what you're doing here?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I understand." And I got to tell you, I didn't have a clue what I was about to do. I didn't know. I just wanted to feel better. Unconsciously, I just wanted to be more like these people in AA. I just wanted to fit. And I don't know really what I'm doing. And what happened over the next 10 months was some of the most painful, disheartening, and hectic time of my early sobriety. From the moment I said that prayer, crazy stuff started occurring in my life. I was living in a two-bedroom apartment. I had a roommate. I was living paycheck to paycheck from this job I was working at, struggling to get by. In no time, right after taking that prayer, I lost my job. I didn't just lose my job. I couldn't get another job in that venue. I'd been working in a recovery house. I put resumes in every helping institution in the county, and every door was closed on me. And I can't get another job, and now I'm scared because now I can't pay my half of the rent. Then my roommate moves out. Now I really got to – I can't handle it with a roommate because I don't have a job. Now I don't have a job and a roommate, and I got all the bills are mine now. And I've got visions of homelessness coming at me, sober. I went to my sponsor and told him – I was frantic about this. I'm nuts. And I'm telling him about it. I got all this fear and anxiety. And he says, "Oh, don't worry about it. You're right on course." I thought, oh, for what? A train wreck? I was dating a girl. She dumps me. I found myself going through these emotional upheavals, the crazy stuff. Like I'd just be sitting watching TV or drinking a cup of coffee. Nobody's done nothing to me. Nothing's happened. And all of a sudden, I'd just start crying. As if emotions that had been pent up inside of me for decades started coming out of me. And they ain't coming out pretty. And I'm freaking out. I'm thinking, oh my God, come to AA, and I'm going to find out I'm gay. It was embarrassing because I come from that old school of thought, you know, guys don't cry, right? And I'm wimping out here, and I don't know what's going on. And what's going on is that God is doing exactly what I ask Him to do. When I said to Him, I said, God, I'm offering myself to You for You to build with me and to do with me as You will. I was like a burnout building that somebody's trying to rehab. You, God got right to work on it. And to do that, you got to tear out a lot of crap in order to make room for new stuff. Why am I in so much emotional pain? Because what's happening is causing me pain? No. The problem is that God never gave me the blueprints of my life for my approval. If God had called me up and say, "Oh, Bob, hey, Bob, you know, you got to get out of that job, Bob. That's a dead end street for you, Bob. That ain't gonna go nowhere. We got to get you over here because you're eventually going to work at this place and eventually own this business, and you're going to do very well financially and be able to retire young and be set for life. Would that be okay for you, Bob?" But he didn't say that. He just took the job, right? If he had said, "Bob, your roommate's got to go because there's a guy from Florida moving to town, and you and him are going to be roommates for a while, and you're going to go do a lot of 12-step work together. It's going to lift your program to a new level. Would that be okay for you, Bob?" I'd have said, "Yeah." Or if he would have said, "That girl you're going out with, you know, she's going to drink again, Bob. She'll never get sober again, and the guy that's with her is going to drink with her. We got to get her out of your life." I'd say, "Okay, God." And if he would have said, "You know, you're blocked. Your spirit's blocked. You got emotions pent up inside you that you've never been in touch with. We have to air them out. We have to ventilate them so you can eventually get free. Would that be okay for you?" I'd have said, "Okay." But instead, he didn't say anything. He just took the job. He took the roommate. He took the relationship. And he started bringing stuff out in me. And he's doing exactly what I ask him to do. What is causing me pain is not what's going on. It's my judgment of what's going on that is making me insane. And the first thing that I am trying to turn over to surrender, to let go of in this process, the first thing I'm deciding is my will, which is really my judgment of everything. How often over the years that I've been in distress or emotional pain or depressed, when I look back objectively, everything was fine. Everything was fine. It is my self-centered wanting to play God judgment of everything that's making me crazy. Actually, everything's in divine order. Divine order. And the problem that I experienced in my first 4 years of sobriety is that I would get down on my knees every morning. It became a habit with me. To this day, I still do this. Maybe not every morning anymore, but I still do it frequently. As I say that third step prayer, it's become part of my life. And I would get up off my knees after saying the third step prayer with the intention of giving God my life. And 5 minutes later, I'm in my head, anguishing over what might happen or this or that, or I get this isn't right and that's screwed up, and I don't know that what I'm trying to do in essence is I'm trying to give God my life, and yet my ego wants to still retain itself, which is my will. And let's say you give your life to God, but you maintain and hold your opinion and judgment of your life, aren't you really saying, "God, here's my life and here's a list of how it better go," right? And what is fear and anxiety? It's the fear of me losing something in my willful judgment I think I have to have, or the fear of not getting something that my will, my judgment tells me I have to have. It's the anxiety of playing God. And what's and I get I'm plagued with anxiety and I'm plagued with depression. You know what depression is? That's when God stops doing your will. You know, where you start saying things to, like you see somebody with a nicer life than you got, and you go, after all I've done for him. So I haven't done it. And the second line in this prayer, I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self. And that's the problem, is that I am in the bondage of self. I am, and I like the words bondage, because I am shackled and hostage to my own obsessive self-involvement. In the very back of the book, there's a doctor, in the medical view of alcoholism, there's a doctor, Bill Baer, who in 1946 observed us and made a report on the radio of what he thought AA was. And he nailed us. He says here, he says they know, these are people that know they must never drink. And he says they help others with similar problems. And in that atmosphere, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself. That's always been the problem. I have an excessive, obsessive over-concentration on myself and my life and my past and my future and my feelings and my security and my relationships and my money and me, 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 me. And I'm nuts. Totally self-consumed. So I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self, because if he doesn't do that, how am I gonna give him my life for him to build with and do with me as he wills? That's really pretty much taking a position of making your life none of your business. How can I make my life none of my business if I'm obsessively focused on myself? And I've always been that way. I don't know about you guys. I wake up in the morning. First thing I'm worrying about is me, pretty much. Just now, there might be some Al-Anons in the room that wake up worried about you, but I don't know. It's me. The only time I worry about you is if it has to do with me. Right? Then I'm real worried about you, because you gotta do better so I'll be all right. I'm self-obsessed. That's where all the fear comes through. I was 10 years sober, and I'm taking a guy. We're about to do a third step, and we've gone through these two and a half pages of the book, and we're at the third step prayer. And I said to him before we said it, I said, I want you to tell me what you think in your own words, what you're going to do here. And he takes a minute, looks at the prayer, and he says, well. He says, in the first line, I guess I'm making a decision that from now on, I'm going to have the intention of trying to make my life none of my business. I'm going to head in that direction. I said, yeah, I think that's right. I think that's my experience. I think that's exactly right. And then he says, I can't do that because of this self-obsession, so I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self so that I can do that. Because if he doesn't relieve me of the bondage of self to some degree, I can have great intentions. I can't carry it out because it's still all about me. And then he hits me with something that I blew my mind. And I'd been saying this prayer every single day for 365 days a year for over 10 years. And I never got this. And the guy, he looks at the last line and he says, I'm asking God to take away my difficulties with the bondage of self, that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. And he looks at me and he says, oh, we're doing all this just so we can help other people. And I'm over 10 years sober. I don't even get that. I think it's still about me. Oh, take away my difficulties. I got a list, too, let me tell you, man. But it's to take away my difficulties with the bondage of self for one reason and one reason only, so I can be a servant. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place in the world that it's like this. It's backwards. our leaders, the top of the food chain in AA, the highest position you can get to in recovery is servant. The highest. Most places, you come in a servant, work yourself up to big shot. We come in big shots, work ourselves up to servants. We really do. Because we are. Every newcomer's a big shot. Oh, you don't know who I am. Yes, we do. Yes. Yes. We unfortunately, we know who you are more than you do. Yeah. No, we know who you are. Yeah. And my friend Terry says that this is the formal terms of surrender. That is what I have to give up is my will. For matter of fact, this sounds crazy, but I think if I could surrender my will, absolutely, I can keep my life. Because God will be working it, and it'll all be good, and I won't be in conflict with nothing. I think it's the reason it says will first is will is paramount. Good.
Oh, I just broke my glasses. It's all right.
You need a new pair of glasses?
I need a new pair of glasses. I need a new pair of glasses. When he was talking, I was just thinking about, speaking of a new pair of glasses, Chuck Chamberlain did a workshop, I guess in about 1972, called A New Pair of Glasses, and then they wrote a book about it from the workshop that he did. And in there, he says that my life is none of my business, that's God's business. My business is helping God's kids, but my life is none of my business. And I just, when Bob was saying that, I can remember when Frank told me the first time that, you know, my life was none of my business. And I just, you know, if you're 6 months sober, that doesn't make any sense. That just doesn't, what do you mean? I've been struggling all my life, planning and doing all this stuff. And it's, you know, then later on in sobriety, I heard this thing I'm sure all of you've heard, says, you know, if you want to make God laugh, just go tell him your plans. You know, it's just all of this stuff that I've got this idea of what I think I'm going to, what I think my life should look like. And then like Bob says that, you know, God has the blueprint, but he didn't give it to me. Or as Dottie says, God knows what he's doing. He's just hadn't told you. And what happened was, is I'm just going to share something that, a few things. In 1993, first off, let's just say some of the things I didn't think that were fair. Like I didn't understand this prayer. The first thing was I sobered up, and to my surprise and couldn't believe, there stood my 14-year-old son, and he's a full-blown drug addict. And I don't even know it. I'm so busy, you know, obsessing about me and what's going on with me, I don't even realize what's happened to my child. So that's the first thing. And it's like I have this idea, well, you know, I'm sober. You know, I'm God's, you know, somehow or another, I'm supposed to be rewarded for being sober. It's, you know, it's like what my mother used to say. My mother and father are not alcoholics. In fact, my daddy, he died very young at age 60 years sober. My mother was 87 years sober when she died. My parents aren't the least bit impressed with my sobriety. You know, their deal was if you didn't do, you know, you should have been doing this all along anyway. But see, they don't understand the disease. But the fact of it is, you know, I wasn't paying any attention. And all I'm even taking this prayer and looking at it and thinking it's all about me. That God's going to relieve my difficulties. And that all of a sudden everything is supposed to be, you know, I'm not supposed to have any problems. But that's not it at all. And the first thing is I wake up and find out my son's a drug addict. Then, you know, my husband has two children. We find out three of them are alcoholics and drug addicts. That makes for a wonderful marriage to be living with all of that. And Then in 1993, our grandson, our very firstborn grandson, is born deaf. I'm really angry. I don't understand what God's doing. It seems like I need to do something to make this not happen the way it is. And then in 1993, on top of that, my husband lost his job. That's when the bottom fell out of aerospace in Southern California. And my husband's a computer scientist, and he didn't work in his field again for 2 years. And he had like a bunch of, minimum wage jobs. And it was humiliating. It was embarrassing. It was all of these things. And I was so embarrassed and so humiliated in AA. And all of a sudden, I can't float our boat. I'm working, but I can't pay the mortgage by myself. I can't do these things. We cannot give our house away. Our whole block is up for sale. We cannot give our house away. So what we have to end up doing is we have to short sell our house and get rid of our house, making no money on our house. And so all of this time up until now, we had this great plan. He'll get a job. I mean, he's a computer scientist. This will all happen. So we're making house payments on credit cards, and we're doing all this kind of stuff. And it's like his no job is in sight. And we can't even sell this house to get rid of the house to pay back the credit cards because nobody's buying houses. We sold the house, ended up selling for about $30,000 less than what was owed on it. That kind of market, kind of like we're in right now. And I'm humiliated. And we've got to go into this house and we've got to rent. Now we go and get this house that's twice as big as the house we owned. For half the money. And all of a sudden, my husband and I look at each other and we say, God, like, this is God's house. Look how big this house is. It's just the two of us. How big this house is. The next thing we know, people are living with us. We got people living with us from time to time. Then Dave eventually gets a job but that's not before we had to file bankruptcy because we couldn't pay. And I was horrified and mortified. You don't do this in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't do this. What step are you working if you have to file bankruptcy? That's stealing. You can't do that. And then we get people who are more sobriety than us and tell us, this is what you have to do for now. And I don't want to do that because my ego doesn't want to do that. And I look at Frank Honeycutt, and he was my hero. And I look at Frank and I said, what will people think of us if we file bankruptcy? Because you see, the other thing is, I can't not tell you that. Because I've already been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to live my life out loud. Now, this is 16 and 17 years of sobriety, and I'm stuck on step three. I'm right there. I'm stuck. 16 and 17 years of sobriety, my husband and I are. These are the things that are supposed to happen to newcomers, not 16 and 17 years sober. I don't want this to be a witness to others. And I remember I spoke at the Women's International in Omaha in 1995. And I'm sharing this. And I had another friend that was sharing too, and we were kind of, both of us were kind of in the same boat. And she looked at me and she says, boy, are we a lot of hope for the newcomer. This is just stay sober 16 years and this is what you can have. And so then somebody would come up and they'd say, oh, thank you so much for sharing because I've been going through the same thing. And I know because you're sharing, that if you can get through it, so can I. And thank you for being the example. Well, I don't like the example. And I get back in the elevator and I'm with my girlfriend and I looked at her, not a very nice thing. I said, I am sick and tired of being the effing example. I don't want to be the example. But what happened was, is I got to bear witness to those I would help of God's power. I got to bear witness. Okay, I was living proof that you can live through bankruptcy. I'll guarantee you it's humiliating. It'll take the big shotism out of you. All of a sudden, I didn't know much and couldn't, you know, I was right-sized. You know, Dave and I were right-sized because we didn't think that something like this could happen to us. We didn't believe that could happen to us. But you can stay sober. And my AA sponsor says I have to get behind the podium and tell the truth and tell what's happening. These things wouldn't be happening to me in my life if I weren't supposed to share them. And it says so right here in this prayer. This is why. It's none of my business what I need to learn. I have finally come to the conclusion that life is a spiritual classroom. That's just what life is. We're here to learn whatever lessons we need to learn. Now, I didn't know that I was going to move into a house that was half the money of what I was paying for a house, that I would get to have people live with us and get to help them and make relationships that I would treasure all the days of my life. I didn't know that my husband would get a job, that he'd get a company car. And the car I'm driving today, I still call it God's car. Because there were people who needed cars to go to job interviews, to do all kinds of things. And I could say, I have a car. But my husband had a company car, and I could drive his car. I didn't know those things were going to work out like that. I also didn't know we got some help. We went to people who could help us financially pull out of this. And when my husband started working and we had the extra income, they said, okay, you were paying twice as much for the house you owned. Why don't you just save that other half every month along with your 401k? Why don't you just save that money and see what happens? And in 10 short years, I had no idea what God was going to unfold. In 10 short years, Dave and I are living in the Pacific Northwest in a house that we practically paid cash for. Because God gave us a way that I had no idea was going to unfold that way. Had no idea. Lots of help from AA. Lots of, you know, how you can bear witness to say, okay, look at these kind of things have happened. But by doing what we're taught to do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and let my life be none of my business, it'll unfold till this. Somewhere in this book, I can't remember where it is, but I'm sure Bob can remember. It says that we have to trust the process. And sometimes it's really hard for me to trust the process. And that's trusting God in my life. It's getting in that wheelbarrow and trusting the process that this is happening. And it doesn't seem like there's any kind of good that's ever going to come out of this. Absolutely no good at all. And for me, has been, every time I think about it, I go to Dr. Paul's. There are no negatives in God's world. Absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And I believe that most of the things that happen to me because it's something I need to learn spiritually. And it's amazing how much I learned spiritually. One of the biggest lessons I learned at 16 and 17 years of sobriety, even though my intentions were good, like I was putting a house payment on a credit card with the anticipation that we would get a job or sell the house and we would have the money, what I learned, the biggest lesson I ever learned is, don't spend money you don't have, no matter what the intention is, even though the intentions are good. That's amazing. Doesn't seem like it's that difficult. I mean, I had such good intentions. I wasn't meaning to rip anybody off. I wasn't meaning to do that and have to file bankruptcy. My intention was that we would save our house. But again, why are we saving our house? For me. What it would look like if you didn't. You know, it's all that stuff about what am I going to look like? What am I going to look like? And, you know, a lot of things have happened as a result of that kind of humiliation. And that is, I learned a lesson that my AA sponsor says, and that no matter what happens, I have to live my life out loud. And that's what it's trying to say here, that if you'll take away my difficulties, and I believe my difficulties, the biggest difficulty I have is what are you going to think of me? And that difficulty, when it's removed, I can tell you a truth, and then maybe my life and the experiences I've had will help somebody else. But I've got to be willing to allow myself to tell you what has happened in my life, no matter how humiliating or how degrading that is, because that experience has happened to me so that I can share it with somebody else and bear witness for a God that has brought me through that difficulty. I want to just share with you about my grandson, Ryan. My grandson, Ryan, on the 23rd of May, in a few weeks, will be 15 years old. And he is in the ninth grade. And he is totally integrated into public school. And this little boy goes to school at Evanston High School in Illinois. And that high school is 4,400 students. And Ryan is the only deaf student in that school. And he steps up to the plate every day. He has an interpreter. He also has a cochlear implant, but he's very borderline recipient for it. So it works just marginally. But he suits up and shows up every day for school. And he has an interpreter. And I look at him and I think, you know, I think I was so into myself. It was so much about me. That I always thought, I'm so different, I'm so, you know, I was just steeped in self-pity, always thinking about me. And Ryan suits up and shows up every day and goes to a high school of 4,400 students where he not only thinks he's different, he is different. And he steps up to the plate every day and does that. And he has been. And I don't believe that that's any mistake. I don't think that's a mistake. I think his life is a testament to God's love. It's a testament to what you can do when you're raised by parents who are both in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and have been relieved of the bondage of self and were willing to step outside themselves and give to a child who has difficulties and be relieved of that bondage of self and walk with him and watch him overcome a difficulty far worse. That's the prayer. That's the prayer. There are no mistakes. There are no mistakes in God's world, and nothing happens by accident. That's it.
Well, we're going to come back.